This is Modern Physics 2710, and the date is the 20th of March 2007, and we are going to do Chapter 9 today. I love this quote at the beginning of the chapter about all the guys who went cuckoo studying statistical physics. Perhaps it will be wise to approach the subject cautiously. Ludwig Boltzmann died by his own hand. Paul Ehrenfest died similarly. Now it is our turn to study statistical mechanics.
Don't take your
own lives over this chapter.
Let's not risk it.
I thought it was just bad, go to
chapter 10. Chapter 10 has a wonderful quote at the beginning of it as well. The secret of magnetism. Now explain that to me. There is no greater secret except love and hate.
Yeah, that's a little too dramatic. Let's skip that one, too.
chapter 10 uses...
You'll have us all the way through the book before the end of the day here. I do have, if it came up, some PowerPoint stuff that we can use to guide us through our discussion if you want to, but you have to ask questions today.
I have questions.
All right.
Yeah, chapter 9 makes no sense.
That's what I have questions on.
That's what I feel like in every chapter.
Chapter 9 is a little weird, and that's why we're not spending a lot of time in it. But there are some highlights, some important points we want to look at. There are a few important ideas in here that I think you ought to remember, kind of at least generally, for the future. But I'm neither prepared nor interested in going through all of the details of the derivations.
They're like, we're going to explain this, but this is here.
I can make, just to get you started, because I really am going to depend on you to ask questions today, but just to get you started, I can make a kind of a general comment about statistical physics and the fact that if we think we know mechanics really well and Newton's laws and F equals ma, and if we knew that for every single particle in the universe, then in some theoretical realm, we might be able to predict any future state of the universe if you knew the position of every single one of the 10 to the 80th atoms in the universe. And its velocity, so you have to know three components of position and three components of velocity, or likewise momentum, then you could, in theory, predict which one would collide with which one, and it would bounce off this way and collide with that, and that would constitute a thought in your brain. And then, in other words, the world would be predetermined. It was a deterministic mechanical universe. In theory, you could do that with Newton's laws, but in practice, there's no way we can ever approach that. Now, quantum mechanics says that even in theory, Newton's laws don't give us the whole story, and we have to worry about probabilities and non-deterministic outcomes that are random. So we've escaped the nightmarish death of a deterministic universe anyway, on theoretical grounds with quantum mechanics. But even before quantum mechanics, on practical grounds, there's no way that you can compute all of that stuff for all the particles in the universe, and so we end up using statistical methods to talk about large ensembles of particles. And in a gas, for example, you have atoms zipping around randomly, so to speak, hitting into each other, bouncing off. Those collisions make the pressure, and their speed is related to the temperature and all that stuff. But in general, if you talk about the pressure and temperature, those are kind of macroscopic quantities based on microscopic happenings that are going on. To make the connection, we have to use statistics, large number statistics. And that's kind of where this all comes from. It does make a good case for it. The fact that we get some good results out of this leads us to believe that statistical physics is actually very important. Even though, as a student, it wasn't my favorite portion of physics, it is very important and been very useful. Phase space? Shall I prod you with questions? What's phase space?
Six-dimensional pseudospace. It has to do with what you were saying, the position and velocities.
But you're right. Can you elaborate a little bit? Are they, like, can you draw six dimensions on a...
Mm-hmm.
We don't care if we draw them, though. If we can do the math on them, it doesn't matter if you can picture them. Are they physical dimensions? Well, some cases they might be. Three of them, if you talk about X, Y, and Z as three of those six, you can think of those as physical spatial dimensions, but the others aren't. And so it's not space, that's why we call it phase space, but you can still do computations and draw graphs and stuff in phase space. What's the point of all that? Why do we invent this idea of phase space?
It's kind of what I wanted to know.
It makes things easier.
How? What does it make easier?
Stuff.
Because things depend on them, like to find stuff, you need stuff. Those. I don't know.
Teresa, you have any comments on phase space and why we invented it?
Just because, I don't, I mean, what I got out of it is something about it was a way to count up degrees of freedom, so you could, because there's energy associated with each of those degrees of freedom.
Okay.
For, like, I don't know.
Okay, that's good. We're trying to make a micro-macro connection here between the small collisions of the individual particles and the macroscopic quantities of temperature and energy and things like that. And so this phase space helps us compute average speeds, most probable speeds, RMS speeds, and most, when we think of the probabilities, it makes us think of psi star psi back in our quantum theory days and integrating over the volume of the shells. Well, that's still true. It says right here, where does it say this? I'm on the bottom of page 275. We think of the distribution function f of v as playing a role analogous to the probability density psi star psi in quantum theory, but now we have to integrate over phase space as well as the real space to get the speeds that we want to know. They divide it up into each of the three components, but over on equation 9.8, they talk about the average kinetic energy. The bar over the top, of course, means an average quantity. We've seen that before. So the average kinetic energy is the average of 1/2 mv squared, and you can see how they derive all that, and you get 3/2 kt, but that's a result we already knew from thermal physics. Boltzmann and others before had told us about that. So this is a nice confirmation that statistical approach is a good way to learn things, that it actually agrees with what we already knew from our kinetic theory of gases and thermal physics in the first place.
I'm not sure I understood how they wrote that.
Which
this,
one?
The velocity distribution function, like, that's the probability of finding it. Is that just kind of like a derivative type thing?
Just the notation?
Uh-huh.
Okay, f of v is the function of the velocity distributions, but the probability we have to integrate over the volume of the phase space. So that d cubed v is actually a little thing to remind you that we're really doing a three-dimensional integral. It's really probably better thought of in your calculus book as dx, dy, dz. The d cubed means there's three of them, and the v just means it's a volume
like
differential.
Like an a instead of your dy, dx.
Yeah, it's a dv, so it's a three-dimensional infinitesimal element, but they've doubly indicated that with the superscript 3, showing that it's a three-dimensional volume element. To tie that in and maybe help make a little bit more sense, do you remember the mechanical universe video we saw where they were trying to show the probability of finding an electron in the hydrogen atom at certain distances from the radius? The psi function itself is very large toward the center, or even psi star psi is very large at the center of the at the nucleus of the hydrogen atom. But we talked about the volume of a spherical shell there being very small. And so when you multiply the psi star psi times the volume of the shell, that brought that function back down to zero at zero. So the probability of finding it at zero is zero, even though the function itself was large there. Just due to the fact that the farther away from the nucleus of the hydrogen atom, that shell has more and more volume in it. And so that produces that shape of that little hump shape that tells us the A naught for the Bohr radius of the hydrogen atom. This is similar in spirit in that we're going to integrate that too, and we have to take into account the volume in phase space of the shell.
So is that what it's saying? Like a volume in phase space is really velocities?
Yeah.
So it's that same idea, just
so,
talking about velocities and stuff.
In fact, in the paragraph, it explains, it puts it in words, what the equation is trying to say. It starts, therefore, f of v dqv is the probability of finding a particle dvx, so a small shell in the x direction, and the y component of v between v sub y and v sub y plus dv sub y. They're just doing this in each direction, but you're understanding here that you're trying to find the probability of finding it in a small space or small region in that component between some value and then the next close infinitesimal value. Does that make sense? Do I need to draw a picture?
If it would help, maybe.
Okay. some function. The ones that we've seen for the hydrogen atom look kind of like that, where that was the Bohr radius. What we're saying, though, is that in this case, f of v, that's a bold one, right? That's a vector v. Is that what it says in the book? Times in one direction, say this is the x direction, then you have some value, pick one, doesn't matter. I mean, it's going to be a function of this. You have to look at all of them eventually, but one at a time. So some x, and then the next one over is, let's see, let's put this down here so we can see it. X plus delta. Delta x is the way you did it probably the first time you saw stuff like this. X plus delta x. Only they're saying this is actually not a spatial coordinate. It's a velocity coordinate. This is v sub x. So this is a graph of the x component of the velocity. So that's not x. It's really v sub x. And so the one next to it is v sub x plus the little delta, the little infinitesimal, dv sub x is the next spot over. And the idea is that this is telling us that you're trying to find the probability that the particle has a velocity in that region. Out of the whole graph, what's the probability that it's in there, or that the velocity is between this value and this value? Only you don't just do it in the x, you also do it in the y, and you also do it in the not spatial x, y, z, but velocity components. Velocity in the x, velocity in the y, velocity in the z.
That function of v?
Yeah.
That's, what is that? Is it going to be?
That'll be your different,
different
distributions of the speeds. See, not all of the particles in your gas are going to have the same speed. Some of them will be fast and some of them will be slow. And this is the probability of finding one that is medium fast, or if we went to the tail of the curve, what's the probability of finding one that's really fast? Or closer down, what's the probability of finding one that's slow? Only again in all three dimensions, all three velocity phase space dimensions. And we'll see that in specific cases, whether we use classical thinking or quantum thinking, that we'll get different velocity distributions for these things. The Fs will look different. In fact, are we ready to skip ahead to that? Briefly, skip ahead to, 9.4 on page 980, section 9.4. It's nice and helpful somewhat. Lagrange and Hamilton did computational stuff. They were mathematicians. Laplace, Pierre-Simon de Laplace, was the one that took Newton's laws of motion and said, if we know the position and velocity of every particle in the universe, well, think about it at a more philosophical level. I made the case earlier that we don't know all of the positions and velocities of every particle in the universe, but if we did, then we could say what the state of the universe, classically speaking. What the universe is going to be like, and every particle in it. That means every atom in your brain, every state it's going to be in, every thought you have, every action you perform, every choice you make would be predetermined if we could calculate those. But actually, Laplace said, and Newton never did this, Newton never went this far, but Laplace said, well, if Newton's laws are true, then it doesn't really matter whether we can but even though we can't practically compute this, the very fact that they have a specific position and velocity means that the universe is deterministic. We may not know what the state of the universe is going to be 30 years from now because we can't compute every particle in the universe precisely now, but that state 30 years from now is already predetermined because even though we don't know what it is, it's determined by Newton's laws. So he's the guy that gave us a deterministic universe. Doesn't sit well with a lot of people. So some philosophers and religious folk were very happy when quantum mechanics came along and said, it's not deterministic, but they didn't really like it being run by dice either, Einstein. Anyway, back to statistical stuff. Benjamin Thompson was named or given a title of Count. He's Count Rumford. He's actually an American. Went to live, I think, in Britain somewhere, and he got a title. I don't remember how the story goes exactly, but he's an American. And he had this idea that heat is not a substance. It's not this caloric stuff that flows from hot things to cold things. It's not a fluid. but it's just merely made up of the individual motion of the kinetic particles in a substance. That idea is really important to all of thermodynamics and statistical physics. Joule, you have a picture of the Joule apparatus in your book on page 274, the paddle wheel apparatus that warmed up the fluid by the paddles moving around as the weights dropped. It's basically the equivalent of heat, the mechanical equivalent of heat experiment that we did in our lab when we turned the crank on this aluminum cylinder with the cord wrapped around it. You remember that experiment? It's basically this. Maxwell we think of mostly with electricity and magnetism, but he's also very important in statistical physics and did a lot of these computations. He's an excellent mathematician. And then Einstein, relativity, he actually, 1905, same year, published a theory on Brownian motion that helped make people believe in the atomic theory of matter and kinetic theory in general. And then you know about Bohr. Okay, we mentioned these six parameters. Look at the very bottom of this screen. This is, helps explain a little bit better the notation, Marty Lynn, about the d cubed v thing. The very bottom you see it's dv sub x, dv sub y times dv sub z. Three-dimensional, only phase-based three-dimensional volume element that we're going to have to integrate over. Is that helping, making any sense here?
Yeah.
Yeah?
It's not something that's visual, really.
Well, no. I mean...
And I think that's... I was thinking that it was all supposed to make sense. It?
On the one hand, you do know how to think of a three-dimensional volume element for three real spatial dimensions, x, y, and z, and you can do it in x, y, z coordinates and have dx, dy, dz. Or you can do it in spherical coordinates. You know how to do all that stuff. And so you can at least envision what a three-dimensional element would be, but you are right. These are not spatial coordinates we're talking about. They're velocity component coordinates. So it's still a three-dimensional infinitesimal element, but they're not physical spatial infinitesimal elements. So Maxwell showed that the probability distribution function is this stuff right here. You asked what the F of all this is. Well, that's the F. Oops, go back. It's proportional to this. So this piece is this right here, and there's the proportionality constant. And this d cubed v is just this d cubed v, so you can even ignore it to find out what the F part is. The F is everything else except the d cubed v. And you can actually compute what C has to be, and it's what beta is, k 1 over kt. Okay, then they just do this in three dimensions. Okay, this is the normalizing procedure, because if you integrate from negative infinity to infinity, this again is similar to our normalization that we did with quantum mechanical wave functions. We said the particle has to exist somewhere, so if you integrate over all space, then the probability has to be 1. The same idea here, only still, Marty, this is not physical space, this is phase space, but still it's true that if you integrate from negative infinity in terms of the velocities, that the component of the velocity of any particle has to be between negative infinity and positive infinity. So if you need to do this integral, it still has to be 1, for the same reason that we used that argument before. So that helps you find out what these constants are. Constants of integration, normalization constants. Then, if you know all that stuff, you can compute the average value. It gives you that graph. They go through the computations to find these three different things. But if you know this function, then you can do various mathematical tricks to find these specific values that you might be interested in. This one right here is the one they're calling V star. And it is the most probable one, and we know that because it has the highest value. It's the peak. It's the tip of the peak. There is no other value of the speed that has more particles with that speed than this one. This one has the most of any, so it's the most probable speed. It doesn't mean the majority of particles have that speed. It just means that more than any other speed have this speed. So that's the most probable speed. Peak is V star. How would you find it mathematically? If you know the shape of this function. The derivative is equal to 0. That's how we find the maximum of any curve. So take the derivative of your function and set it equal to 0, and you get v star. Then you can also find the average speed, and it turns out to be, what does it say, a few percent higher than v star. And you could get that. You also know how to get average values by adding them all up and dividing by the total number. You do that with integrals, you know how to do that too. And then you can also compute VRMS, and they do all these computations in great detail. which I don't necessarily want to repeat all of, but they are done on page 282 and 283. Most probable speed is equation 915. The average speed, or the mean speed, is equation 917. And the RMS speed, the root mean square speed, is equation 920. And they kind of show you how they get each of those. The mean speed is 13% higher, and the RMS speed is 22% higher than the most probable speed, because it's not symmetric, it's skewed. Any questions about that? We did skip a little bit, I might go back to, but any questions about that?
What would be the significance of the root mean square speed?
The significance, or what you'd use it for?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, why are they interested in it?
We have a question for homework in our other physics class asked about that.
Well, you had to compute some stuff. Does it answer the question as to why you care?
Because we need it.
Just for fun.
I don't remember seeing anything.
No, I don't think they do much with it here. Marty, do you use that a lot in your thermal class?
I don't have a thermal class. You don't. We used it in circuits for a little while.
We did use the idea of root mean square things in circuits. We'll do that in our other physics class when we get to AC circuits. We'll use the idea of RMS. But I don't see where they use V sub RMS much in this chapter after they derive it. So,
what is it, like, I don't know, what does it mean, like, physically? I didn't really get that. Or is it just,
well, I'm not going to help you much, but I'm just going to kind of repeat what it means mathematically, and it means it's...
Okay.
That speeds, velocities are randomly oriented, which means on average there'd be as many with an x component that way as there would be with an x component that way. So if you average the velocities, you get nothing, basically, because it's a random guess. So that didn't work. So if you don't want just a zero answer for your velocity, you have to do something with it, like take the absolute value. Well, that's the speed. Mm-hmm. Speed is the magnitude of the velocity. So you can find the average speed. Well, that's the other number we already took. But the other way you can make sure that things that might have opposite directions don't cancel out is to square them first, because then you have all positive quantities rather than having one positive and one negative canceling each other out. So if you square all the speeds first, then average those, and then take the square root, because you didn't really want the square. You have to square them to get them all positive, then you average that, then you take the root of that. That's the RMS. It's not the same as the mean, though. Now, where it is in the formulas, I don't know. I don't see it here, but I know the concept we will use in AC circuits. Let's talk about the equipotentiation theorem. It's up here on the screen, and this equation that you see on the screen is also 9.8 on page 277. And it says that the mean translation kinetic energy of a molecule is 3 halves kT. And I don't know if you've studied enough thermal to recognize that as an important quantity, but that's pretty well known. For the translational kinetic energy of a gas, it's 3 halves kT. In fact, that's the average kinetic energy is directly related to the temperature. Well, there it is. I mean, you see that. That's the tie-in. If you want a definition of temperature, you can say it's 2/3 divided by, well, put this K, these are different Ks. That's the Boltzmann constant. In the, you know, just solve the first and last part for T, and you can say T is 2/3 average kinetic energy divided by the Boltzmann constant. That's what temperature is. It's directly proportional to the average kinetic energy of the molecules. That's all well and good. That means, though, that it can absorb energies. As you put energy into your gas, those molecules can move faster in the X direction, they can move faster in the Y direction, and they can move faster in the Z direction. So as you add energy in, you can change the temperature. Well, this makes you think of the specific heat that we did a couple of labs on in our other class. Specific heat is related to adding energy into this object or substance and seeing how much its temperature changes. Different substances have different specific heats. You put the same amount of energy into two chunks of even the same mass, but different stuff, their temperatures might both go up, but not by the same amount. That's the specific heat. However, ideal gas, we didn't do gases, we did solids. The ideal gas specific heat, you have to say, are you going to worry about the specific heat where the pressure's kept constant or where the volume's kept constant? Because you have to keep something constant to know what you're talking about. But there's two kinds of specific heat for ideal gases. They still use the letter C like we did in our physics class, only it's C sub V for a constant volume specific heat, or C sub P for constant pressure specific heat. And we're going to talk about this constant volume specific heat, but it turns out that you can change the temperature of the gas by adding energy into it because the molecules can move faster in the x direction, faster in the y direction, and faster in the z direction. And that determines your specific heat. However, think of an oxygen molecule, which is not an ideal gas in the sense that they're not point particles. The total ideal gas model assumes that they have zero volume and that they're points. But if we're going to consider molecules now, then they're not points. And in fact, the whole idea of a molecule is that it has, at some extent, it's got an atom here and then it's connected with the bond to the other atom here. Think of that as a rigid, massless rod that connects the two oxygen atoms. So we're talking about O2 molecules. That's 20% of the atmosphere we breathe. O2 molecules. You could make very similar arguments for N2 molecules, which is 80% of the atmosphere we breathe. But think of a diatomic molecule as a dumbbell, a barbell thing that's got heavy things on the end and connected by a rigid, massless rod. Now, if you put energy into that, it doesn't all go into translation kinetic energy, because the molecule can take up some of that energy in terms of rotation. You put energy into your system, it doesn't make them move around necessarily faster. They might just start rotating. Of course, what's really going to happen is that you'll get some of both. But the idea is that you now have a rigid rotator in your gas rather than a point particle. And that means that if you add energy in, you can actually, you have more degrees of freedom than just zipping back and forth in the x direction, the y direction, and the z direction. You can also have it rotate in the x direction or rotate in the y, around the y axis. So you actually end up with two more degrees of freedom. And the equipartition theorem, it's right there in the middle of the page, this is something that you ought to actually remember after this class is over. If you go on to any other kind of science or engineering, anything that might possibly related to thermodynamics, this is something you should remember for the rest of your life. The equipartition theorem says that there's a 1/2 kT of energy associated with each, well, it says quadratic term here, but then later on in the paragraph it calls them degrees of freedom. With each degree of freedom, you get 1/2 kT of energy. Back up again to equation 9.8. The reason that equation 9.8 says 3/2 kT is because there were 3 degrees of freedom. You could have velocity in the x direction, velocity in the y direction, and velocity in the z direction. Those are the 3 degrees of freedom for translation. That's where that 3 comes from. But now if you add on to that the idea you might have diatomic molecules that can rotate, rigid rotators, then that can rotate around either the x-axis or the y-axis, and that gives you 2 more. So you actually expect the total amount of energy to be 5/2 kT because you've added another 2 1/2s. And that's actually the case. You compare it with theory and you actually find that out. Look over on page 278, right in the middle of the page, those equations there, the specific heat capacity at a constant volume is 5/2 NK. The energy is 5/2 NKT. This all matches up, and it matches very closely with experiment. If you actually go measure these in the laboratory, this works pretty well. Now, you may be asking, why are there only 2 more degrees of freedom in a rigid rotator? Why can't it rotate around the z-axis? Why don't we have 3 additional degrees of freedom?
It's negligible.
Okay, it could be small if you orient your molecule along the z-axis. But they also say, near the bottom of 277, why don't we include rotations about the z-axis? The answer lies in quantum theory. Quantum theory of the rigid rotator, the allowed energy levels are, it gives you the thing, where I is the rotational inertia. And notice the result is consistent with the quantization of angular momentum. When we talked about angular momentum, we said you could only talk about it being independent in the x and y, and then that determines the z. So there's not a new degree of freedom in the z-axis. We talked about that back in chapter 8. So that all matches with theory. One other thing that your diatomic molecule might be able to do, here's a picture of it on the screen. If you have a rigid massless bar connecting your 2 oxygen atoms, then you have a rigid rotator. But that may not be all it can do either. In real life, diatomic molecules are not connected by rigid massless rods. They're actually connected by flexible massless rods, meaning the chemical bond itself. But that means that not only can this atom or molecule move around the room in three dimensions translationally in space, we've also added two more for rotations around two axes, but now we're going to add even more degrees of freedom because this thing can vibrate. This thing can oscillate back and forth along the bond. And so that gives another degree of freedom. Let's see. And look with me in the middle of 279. In some circumstances, it is better to a better approximation to think of atoms connected to each other by a massless spring rather than a rigid rod. How many degrees of freedom does this add? One may be tempted to say just one because of the potential energy of this force, the spring constant. But there is another degree of freedom that is associated with the vibrational velocity, the kinetic energy. So if you're going to allow these two atoms to oscillate back and forth toward and away from each other, this is in addition to the rotation and in addition to the moving across the room, but the molecule will get longer and shorter as they oscillate back and forth on this spring between them. You actually add two more degrees of freedom, one for the potential energy and one for the kinetic energy. So we now add all these degrees of freedom up, three for translational, two for rotational. Now we've added two for vibrational. You add that up, you have 7 degrees of freedom. The equipartition theorem, which you're going to remember till you die, says that you get 1/2 kT for each degree of freedom. You expect the specific heat at temperatures that excite the vibrational modes to be 7/2 kT. And in fact, that is correct. 7/2 R over whatever the right units are. I probably shouldn't say kT, but 7/2 NK or 7/2 R, depending on if you're talking about the molar specific heat and all that. Now look at this picture right here. You're already looking at it in your book. But this shows that as the temperature gets higher and higher, we see exactly what we expect it to. In low temperature situations down here, the molecules in, well, this is an H2 gas, this is not air, this is not O2 or N2, but it's still a diatomic molecule, it's still H2. But you don't excite the rotational modes at low temperatures. And so all you get is these molecules zipping around the room as if they were almost point particles. But as you get to hotter temperatures in here, you can also excite the rotational modes. So you have 3/2 kT here. Notice that's exactly what it is. 3/2 right there. 3/2 R, I guess, in the right units here. 3/2 R. Add 2 more degrees of freedom for rotation. You have 5/2 R. And then when you get up to pretty high temperatures, this is hotter than room temperature here, you get up here, you get to, right there, 7/2 R. And then it dissociates. Then your molecules break apart. The dotted line says that at temperatures in the thousands of Kelvin, it's tough to even keep your H2 molecules together. They just break apart. It's too hot. But before you break them apart, you can see that it was likely to flatten out there where you expected it to at 7/2. This is experimental evidence for this equipartition theorem.
I have a question that sort of has to do with this. Now, this only came about gases, is that right? This wouldn't work with, you're talking about anything else.
Gases, that's correct. And we started off with ideal gases, which are point particles, and then we expanded when we did rotation and vibration to diatomic molecular gases. But yes, you're right, just gases.
Yeah, because I guess, I mean, you know, when you think of specific heats and then, like, changing phase and stuff, where, see, all those are related to temperature, aren't they?
Yep.
Whereas when you do that with other things, the temperature isn't necessarily, unless I don't understand it, right? I don't know.
No, you're absolutely correct. And you just have to realize that our discussion so far has only covered the gases. But look on page 280, the second full paragraph. Let us briefly turn our attention to the thermomolecular motion in a solid. Now the vibrational mode will be of supreme importance, for the atoms in a solid are not free to translate or rotate. So it's different in a solid. They can't go floating around the room, so you don't get those 3 degrees of freedom. In a lattice crystal, they're not allowed to rotate either, so you lose those degrees of freedom. What do you have left? Well, you only have 2 left, except you really have more than 2 because now it's connected by chemical bonds not only along the original x-axis that we talked about before, the rigid rotator, or the non-rigid rotator, but now it's locked into a lattice in three dimensions. So we've lost translation and we've lost rotation, but we do actually now have vibration in three dimensions. And each dimension can have a potential energy degree of freedom and a kinetic energy degree of freedom. So two for each dimension, that's six. So we have 1/2 kT of energy for each of 6 degrees of freedom. So the specific heat should be 6 × 1/2 R, and that's exactly what it is, 3 R. And it says the experimental value of the molar heat capacity is almost exactly 3 R for copper near room temperature. So that's another triumph of this little line of reasoning. Does that help, Teresa?
Yeah, that makes more sense.
It's additional. I mean, the other stuff...
You're quite starting to think of it in general and thinking, how could it be all related to temperature, have to do with temperature, but if it's gases, so it's going to work differently for this.
Yes, right. Yep.
So on this graph in figure 9.4, if it's in the translation area down here, that means that, well, does it mean that there's no way that any of those molecules can rotate or vibrate? They just all have to be...
It just means that the temperature, the energy is not sufficient to excite those modes, and they tend to... It takes more energy to make them rotate and even more energy to make them vibrate. So at low temperatures, those modes are not generally excited, so they're almost like they're not present because they're not rotating and they're not vibrating. They're just zipping around the room at low temperatures.
So if they happen to collide with something like a wall or something, then they...
They could rotate, yeah. And stuff. Yeah, but most of them aren't.
Okay.
It's not saying it's impossible to make one go around. It's just in saying that in general, on average, the energy in the system is not enough to really excite those rotational modes very much.
Okay.
I think what I was trying to explain earlier is fairly well depicted in the picture 9.6 on page 280. I don't know if I have that on the screen. Oh, kind of. This was my attempt at trying to explain that d cubed v thing with the shell, the volume of the shell. This was kind of what we did for the distribution of an electron around a hydrogen atom and trying to find the probability of finding it at a particular R value. And you had to know the volume of a shell between R and R plus dr. And that was a three-dimensional concept because R was actually square root of x squared plus y squared plus z squared. But that's still physical space. That's still really, you know, true x space, y space, z space. In this picture, when we're trying to attack this dv, d cubed v, the volume element in three-dimensional phase space, it's a little different. Notice that the axes here are labeled as v sub x and v sub y, and they forgot to put on the v sub z. You still want to know what the probability of finding the particle is in here, but this is not a physical space now. It's not physically finding it in this location. It's finding the particle with a velocity between this value v and this value v plus dv, where the volume of this shell is dv. What's the volume of a shell? Well, that would be the surface area multiplied by the thickness. You did this in Calc 3. So 4 pi r squared dr is what dv is. But this is in not physical space. This is space.
So it always follows Maxwell's speed distribution?
Classically, it does. We're going to see some places where that falls apart. In section 9.5, it'll talk about classical statistics.
And that's the blue dots in your little V thing.
Well, why do we like classical physics? Well, we learned it first. It's easier. But it's nice, too, because there's no restriction on particle energies. And you don't have these, you know, you have to have restrictions in quantum mechanics. You only take on quantized values. So let's compare these two and see what we get. Rewrite the Maxwell speed distribution in terms of energy. So this was the speed distribution function, now rewritten in terms of an energy distribution function. And that's how we're going to compare these now, is in terms of energy, but speed and energy are related, so we're okay with that. This is how they do it right here. dv is dE over square root of 2me. So dV goes right there, and dE, and you can relate them all. Anyway, what we end up with is this equation down here. That's the Maxwell stuff that we had before. And that's the, still the same piece, and we now have the Maxwell-Boltzmann factor. We call this thing the Maxwell-Boltzmann factor with this coefficient out in front to make sure everything gets normalized that we need to. Now this gets a little hairy in here, and I'm not sure how much time it's worth spending on. It's kind of a deep thought and a deep idea to talk about the density of states, g of e. This is a function that tells us how many possible ways your system, how many different possible states your system can have in a given energy range. It's a kind of a weird idea, but it makes some sense. We'll come back and hit that in just a second. In the quantum distributions, if these are distinguishable, there's four different states for particles in two energy states. You can have both particles in state one and zero in state two, or one in each, or the opposite, or anyway, those are equal probability. There's four of them, then each should be 1/4. But if your particles are indistinguishable, that means you don't know the difference between A and B, so these two states aren't really different. That is to say, having A here and B here is no different than B here and A here. If you can't tell the difference between A and B, if they're indistinguishable, then there's only three possibilities. So each one has a probability of 1/3.
You wouldn't have more probability in that middle one?
Because they're really the same state. You really can't tell the difference between A and B. What you're saying is that here, the idea that one is here and one is here is twice as likely as either that state or that state, because there's two like this. But that's only because you can tell the difference between A and B. You're saying that that's one condition and that's another condition, but now we're saying that they're really not different. You can't tell the difference between those two states. It's really only one. There's only three possibilities for indistinguishable particles. Of course, this scales up to many states, you know, many energy levels, but the idea is that the statistics are different for quantum things where the particles are indistinguishable. We do need to make this conscious distinction between fermions and bosons. Have we talked about these enough before that you can remind me of the difference between them?
Have fermions we done? Are electrons and the neutrons are protons. And spin.
It has to do with spin, yep. And electrons are fermions because their spin is?
½.
Be either up or down, but it can only be 1/2. Protons and neutrons are also spin 1/2. They're also fermions. Bosons have integer spin, and the interesting thing, they'd be like, what do we know that's a boson? Photons. Did you mention photons, Marty?
Mm-hmm.
Oh. Can you think of any other bosons besides photons?
Pions.
One like a helium atom that had both of its electrons in the first shell.
Good.
Wouldn't that be?
As far as fundamental particles go, most of the ones that we're familiar with that make up matter are fermions. The protons and neutrons and electrons pretty much make up everything, and they're all fermions. But Jacob's pointing out an interesting idea, which is true, that if you have an even number of fermions packaged together, then you have a boson. We can have helium atoms that are all paired up and everything's nice. They act like bosons. So, good point. And then the other example we've mentioned so far are photons. They also have integer spin, namely zero, and they're bosons. Now, why does this care? Why does this matter? Why do we care? And the answer is that the physics for fermions is very different from the physics for bosons, especially in the sense that bosons do not have to obey the Pauli exclusion principle. What does the exclusion principle tell us, Miles?
I can't remember. I was just trying to remember. It's they can't be in the same state to...
You're exactly right. Two fermions cannot have the same set of quantum numbers. They can't be in the same state at the same place at the same time, which is the whole reason we built up the periodic table the way we did. Do you remember the video about that? As the electron shells were filled, we had spin up and spin down, and those were different quantum numbers, or different values of the spin quantum number, so that was okay. But once those were filled, there are no other options, and the next electron could not come in and fill that shell because of the Pauli exclusion principle. And it had to go up into the next lowest energy level above it. And that's why we get the whole periodic chart. The atoms fill the way they do, and the chart lines up, and you get atom, the elements to behave the way they do because of the Pauli exclusion principle. But photons don't obey it, which means you can have as many photons in the same place, the same time, the same set of quantum numbers as you want. Now, the Pauli exclusion principle sounds a little bit weird when you first hear it, and like, well, gee, why can't you have two fermions with the same set of quantum numbers? Why can't you have two things occupied the same place, same time, same state? Why not? But then you get used to it. Then it's almost the boson thing that sounds weird. To say that you can have as many photons in the same state as you want might have sounded okay to begin with until you got used to the Pauli exclusion principle. Now it seems backwards. Now you say, gee, how can you have 73 gazillion photons all in the same state, in the same place at the same time? Well, you can, because they don't have to obey the Pauli exclusion principle. In fact, in a laser, they are. We've used lasers in class many times. Why did we like lasers? Do you remember our criteria for why lasers were so good to do spectroscopy with?
Because they had the same...
They're monochromatic and coherent. And what did we say coherent meant?
Same phase difference.
They maintain the same phase difference as they go. Actually, in this sense, what it really means is all of those photons are in the same quantum state, which is wonderful. That's cool. But it can only happen because they're bosons. You can do that with bosons. So your next question that should spring to your lips should be, well, if you can have a whole gazillion photons in the same state, what other bosons did we think of?
Helium
atoms. Can we have a whole pile of helium atoms be in the same state, in the same place at the same time?
Can I say place? No. That's weird.
The answer is yes. They can be in the same quantum state. What do we call that? Superfluid helium. In a metal, a conductor with a current in it, electrons flowing, are electrons fermions or bosons?
I'm
going to
say bosons because... Why would they be fermions? Why
would you even ask? They're spin 1/2 particles. Electrons are fermions. But we've talked about superconductivity in our other class, where as material loses all resistance, and the electrons can flow without any impedance at all. How can that happen? Because they pair up. They're called Cooper pairs. If your electrons, one with a spin up and one with a spin down, get associated with each other, kind of hooked up, joined at the hip. They don't actually have to be next to each other, but they can be quite a ways away. But if you could get your electrons to pair up, guess what you have? Instead of two fermions, you have a boson. And so those can flow and be in the same state, same time. Just like photons in a laser, electron pairs in a superconductor are kind of a bosonic state.
So why is it that the fermions have to obey the Pauli principle, but the bosons don't? It just works out that way.
That's the best answer, but I'll give you another one. I'll give you another answer.
All right.
But before I do, I want to make one more example of cool bosonic states. Lasers are photons that are in the same quantum state, and then we've got this really cool fluid stuff, substance called superfluid helium that flows without resistance, zero resistance, no viscosity. Does that make it sound like something else we've seen? Yeah, the superconductivity, which also flows with zero resistance. And so all of these three examples, lasers, superfluid helium, superconductivity, are all examples of bosonic states where lots of particles can have the same quantum state. There's one more I want to mention, and that is that if you can find atoms other than helium, so they usually use bigger ones, that have everything all paired up too, so that they're normally fermions, but can be bosons if they're paired up. Think quantum mechanically as atoms as having a wave function. A wave function. Well, if you could have atoms with wave functions that had the same wavelength and were all in phase, you'd have an atom laser. And you can have a bosonic condensate where a gas cools down so cold that their wave functions overlap and they merge wave functions. You can have all these bosons being the same quantum state. It's called a Bose-Einstein condensate. It was first seen in 1995, and they got the Nobel Prize for it. It's pretty cool. So why, your question is, why do fermions obey the Pauli exclusion principle, mm-hmm. and why don't bosons have to?
Mm-hmm.
I'll give you a taste of the answer, but the math is deeper than we have time to go into today. But it has to do with the wave equation, the wave functions of these things. If it has a spin 1/2, the wave function is such that if you try to superimpose two of those in the same place at the same time, they're anti-symmetric and they cancel each other if they're in the same place at the same time. We kind of saw that in the video. They tried to show that if you had two electrons with the same quantum numbers, the same wave function that's anti-symmetric, then it would disappear if you put them on top of each other. They actually showed that in the movie. They put them on top of each other and disappeared. I don't know if you remember that. But the bosonic wave functions are not anti-symmetric, they're symmetric, and so they don't disappear when you superimpose them on top of each other. Does that make any sense at all?
The boson ones are anti-symmetric?
Are not anti-symmetric, they are symmetric.
That makes sense, I guess.
Yeah, but if one way it canceled, you'd think they'd amplify each other then as bosons, but it doesn't do that then either.
It well, they... They kind of, well, you still have the superposition. If you want to call that amplification, go ahead. What does the acronym LASER stand for?
Light amplification by stimulated emission of radiation.
Correcto. So if you, the word amplification's in there. Anyway, the Bose stuff is really, really cool. But we better go back and talk a little bit about the Fermi stuff because it leads to our discussion of how electrical conduction works. So Fermi and Dirac, you see their pictures on page 288, excellent quantum mechanists, whatever the word is, came up with this statistics, this idea, and we're supposed to compare, flip back one page to equation 930 and 932. In the blue boxes, we have the Fermi-Dirac distribution, and then below that, the Bose-Einstein distribution. Notice that the math of those looks very, very similar. The only slight alterations being a plus and minus sign, you know, plus sign in equation 930 for Fermi-Dirac and a minus sign in equation 932 for the Bose-Einstein. And the only other difference is what those constants might be, the B sub 1 and B sub 2. This is all summarized in the table 9.2. I think I have a slide of that somewhere. Ideal gases are fairly classical, and they have these distribution functions. The MB stands for Maxwell-Boltzmann. And you remember those guys as classical guys, and Boltzmann is associated with thermodynamics, and that beta right there is 1 over kT. So this is the stuff we talked about first with gases. The particles are all identical but distinguishable. You could, they're all maybe hydrogen or helium atoms in a gas, or maybe they're oxygen molecules, but you can still tell them apart. They're distinguishable in some sense. In Bose-Einstein, they're indistinguishable, and they have integer spin, and in Fermi-Dirac statistics, they're also indistinguishable, but with half integer spin. So the difference here is integer spin and half integer spin. That's what makes a boson versus a fermion. Einstein and Bose worked together on this and came up with this little equation here, and Fermi and Dirac came up with this one. As I said, the only difference is the sign here and what these Bs might actually be. And here are some examples. We talked about ideal gases. We just spent a few minutes talking about Bose stuff. Photons are bosons, and liquid helium-4 is also a boson, and so they can make these Bose-Einstein quantum states with lots of particles in the same state, and they obey this kind of statistical distribution. Now, electrons are fermions, unless it's a superconductor, when they pair up, in which case we call them Cooper pairs. A guy named Cooper invented the theory that explains superconductivity. So not thinking about superconductivity, because if you do, then that's up here. But regular conduction of electrons in a metal, we think of those outermost electrons as being very, very weakly bound to their atoms, so weakly that any slight electric field can pull them off. And then they're just like floating around, almost as if they are an ideal gas. It's almost like they're one of these. Except the difference is now that they're indistinguishable and they have half-integer spin. Think of these as banging around inside the metal, particles like it's a gas, flying around randomly, but the statistics are different because these are fermions. So that's why that's different. But you are supposed to notice that if this factor is much bigger than 1, then you can ignore that 1. And same here. If this factor is much bigger than 1, then you can ignore that one. Does everybody see the math of that, the rationale for why that makes sense? We're taking a limit here. We want to take the classical limit. these last two are both quantum statistics, but we want them to agree with the classical version in the classical limit. So when this is big compared to 1, then this actually, if you ignore the 1, this turns into this, where a is just 1 over b2. See that negative sign there? That just puts it in the denominator. So if this is big and you ignore the minus 1 right here, this thing turns into this, which is what we wanted. Same argument applies here. If this factor is big compared to 1, then you can ignore the 1, and 1 over the e to the beta e is e to the minus beta e. And then the constants have to sort themselves out. But point being that in both cases, these reduce to what we expect or want it to in the classical limit. And that always makes us feel good, because classical physics is still as true as it ever was. Oh, let's look at this diagram here for a minute. These are fermions, Fermi-Dirac statistics. This is the energy axis here, and this is how many particles you're going to find in the energy states. There are different possibilities, different states. They might be degenerate, so there might be a lot of states with this energy. There might be a lot of other states with this energy. There might be a lot of states with this energy, and there might be some states with this energy. But the electrons will fill the lowest states they can, lowest in energy, so they're going to fill these states first, and then these, and then these, and then these, and then these. And at the temperature being 0, this is important here, it will fill these states completely, and none of the states above this magic cutoff energy called the Fermi energy. And all of the electrons will have energy less than that. They'll all occupy energy states that are at E sub F or below. As the temperature rises, however, then some of these electrons get kicked up into higher energy states. So here we have the dotted line still showing this same function form here, but now the temperature is greater than 0. Not all of the electrons are below this Fermi energy. These now have moved to here, which means that those states are not filled, but they start to occupy states up here of higher energy. And this effect gets more and more pronounced as the temperature increases. Now the temperature is hot. It's at the Fermi temperature. And notice that even now, we haven't even got them filled up to the amount we could have up here to 1. These states right here, they're not even all full there, because all of these electrons that were right here are now up in these higher energy states. And then if you look up here even more, this is a different scale. E sub F was over here. We moved it a little bit to the left, so you can see that it's probably where the concavity changes. Here's E sub F here. This now looks like a decaying exponential, which is exactly what you expect for the classical limit. If the temperature is much greater than the Fermi temperature, then you expect to see an energy distribution that's a decaying exponential, meaning, well, you see the functional form is a decaying exponential, but there are a few particles with very high energy, but they're exponentially few of them. There are more and more particles with these energies down here, but you haven't filled up all of any of these yet. They could have filled up into here, and you didn't, because when the temperature's high, that means it's got more energy in it, so these had to go somewhere. Only at T equals 0 will you have this occupying all of the states completely up to there, and then no more. This is Fermi, which means, this is a pretty important distinction here, bosons wouldn't do this. Bosons at temperature equals 0, they'd all pile up in the very lowest energy state. It's only because of the Pauli exclusion principle that we even have to fill up these other states up here at all anyway, in the first place. The first electron comes in and it fills this state right here. Then the next second electron comes in and it fills spin up, spin down, whatever, and then it fills the next. But they can't all pile up in the lowest energy state. The moral of the story is that in a Fermi gas, or a Fermi-Dirac statistic situation, that they do not, even at T equals 0, this is absolute 0 temperature, even at that temperature, the particles do not all have 0 energy. There's this minimum energy that's all of this. There's that much energy in the system, and you can't have any less than that, because the Pauli exclusion principle won't let these particles pile up in these lower energy states. Am I making sense? A Bose gas would all pile up in the lowest energy state. Anyway, this form of this function, we can plug into graphing calculator and actually fiddle with the parameters and increase the T. Remember that T is is in these. Let's see, where do we see that here? Beta. Beta has T in it. Okay? It's 1 over KT. So these are functions of temperature. And so you can actually program this into graphing calculator, and I sent you the files this afternoon. You can fiddle with the parameters and say, if T equals 0, then it's going to look like this, and T is greater than 0, then it looks like this, and you can reproduce these graphs. Any questions about Fermi-Dirac? I have to admit that we are kind of skimming this, but that was the deal we made all along. I think it's a bit deep and a bit mathematical. My goal here is to give you an introduction to the ideas, and that if you ever need to know this for real life later, then you'll at least say, oh yeah, I know what fermions are, I know they have integer spin, I know they obey the Pauli exclusion principle, and I know their statistics are different from bosons. I don't expect you to remember the formulas, but you should at least remember the ideas, and that you could come back and look up the formulas or rederive the equations if you had to, or if you felt like it. For the last few minutes, this whole thing brings up the idea, and this is where we're going to have to end today, because we've already covered the Bose-Einstein stuff. We kind of skipped ahead and did it before. Liquid helium is a Bose-Einstein superfluid. What Jacob pointed out earlier, though, is if two fermions can team up and pair together, then they can make a boson. So there's an isotope of helium that only has a weight of 3 rather than 4. Normal helium has 2 protons, 2 neutrons, and if it's neutral, also 2 electrons. But there's an isotope of helium, it's called helium-3, and it only has 1 neutron. And so things aren't paired up. And so in order to get helium-3 to be a boson, you actually have to have them pair up and have pairs of helium-3s hooked together to make a helium-3 boson. And that's harder to do for a number of reasons. One is the isotope itself is quite rare. You can't find a lot of helium-3. And another reason is that because you have to get them to pair up like this, you even need lower temperatures still. So you have to get way, way, way close to absolute zero to see superfluid helium-3. Understand that it's a totally different phenomenon from superfluid helium-4, where each atom is a boson. In superfluid helium-3, you'd have to get pairs of helium-3 atoms to pair up to get up to be a boson. Anyway, it's fascinating, fascinating stuff. I sent you some URLs today on Bose stuff, lasers and superfluids and superconductors and atom lasers. You might want to read those. But for the last couple of minutes, let's talk about electrical conduction. We've mentioned this recently in our physics class about how to compute the conductivity. This is the inverse of the resistivity. It tells you how easily a metal or some conductor, some material, lets electrons pass through. And this tau is the mean free path. This is the mass, this is the electric charge, this is the number density. And this is the prediction according to the Drude model of classical conductors. This is what his model predicts. Is it exactly right? No. This is what we really ought to get. So that's a failure of the classical theory of conduction. Also, the Drude model predicts that conductivity should be proportional to the 1 over the square root of the temperature. And if you measure it in the laboratory, it's very nearly proportional to 1 over T, not the square root of T. So that's an inconsistency as well. It makes this prediction, but it's wrong. It really should be this. And the heat capacity of the electron gas is 9 halves. Okay, so these are some predictions of the classical theory. And we don't have time to go through all this stuff, but basically it turns out that it fails. So we have to return to the quantum theory and see if that will help us come up with a better model of electrical conductivity. And this density of states thing here with fermions, the electron gas inside your metal is a Fermi gas, so it's going to obey those Fermi statistics that we just got through looking at the graphs of. And here's the density of states. And we're skipping all the math here, but it does turn out that when you do the integrals and check everything out, that lo and behold, it looks a lot better. That this is, there's the, this thing multiplied by that step function gives you this thing. And the heat capacity turns out to be exactly what it's supposed to be. And everything turns out just wonderful. This value of, let's see, the specific heat of copper, the solid copper right here, the specific heat, you measure it to be about that, Well, the quantum theory produces that value. So the quantum theory has proved to be a success. There's another thing about the mean free time. Any concluding questions? You did ask a number of wonderful questions today. Okay, we're through with 9. We'll go on to 10. There are some things in there that are important and some other things that aren't. Especially pay attention to, well, it talks about lasers. You might be interested in lasers because we just mentioned them today. And holography would be fun, too. You don't need to pay quite as much attention to the conductivity, thermal conductivity, if you don't want to. But superconductors are fun, and we'll talk about those. And let's see. Oh, you know what? That article I just passed out today, I thought was chapter 10. It's not. It's chapter 11. So reprieve on that. You don't have to read that tonight. That's for chapter 11.
So get our questions all ready and know exactly what we're going to ask.
Yeah, right? Exactly. Right. Exactly.